Welcome back. Today we're doing a deep dive into a really significant piece of South African legal history. We're looking at the Development Facilitation Act of 1995, Act Number 67. This was a law that wasn't just tweaking things, it was meant to be a fundamental shift, right? Trying to accelerate development post-apartheid.
That's exactly it. Assented to in October 95, the language itself is quite striking. It talks about introducing extraordinary measures. The goal was explicit: speed up reconstruction and development, specifically relating to land. It was a direct answer to decades of distorted spatial planning.
Okay, so extraordinary measures, speed up implementation. That's the mission. What were the sort of core components? How did they plan to actually achieve this?
Oh, you can kind of group it into three main areas. First, they needed a new guiding philosophy, some core principles. Second, new bodies, new institutions to drive it. And third, a specific legal tool, something innovative, to make secure tenure happen faster.
All right, let's start with the philosophy then. Yeah. Section 3 laid out these general principles for land development. You mentioned they were mandatory.
Absolutely mandatory, not suggestions. These were binding guidelines for everyone involved in land development government at all levels. And they covered a lot of ground. Things like demanding integration, you know, social, economic, physical aspects all needed to work together.
Integration, okay. What else?
Well, a big one was discouraging urban sprawl, actively pushing back against it. Historically, sprawl was often linked to segregation, pushing communities further out. So the act aimed for more compact cities and towns.
And I remember reading it explicitly mentions history, doesn't it? Something about correcting past distortions.
Yes, absolutely. A key principle was that development must contribute to the correction of the historically distorted spatial patterns of settlement. It's pretty direct language for a piece of legislation, a clear mandate to undo past injustices through planning.
Wow. Okay. And you also had environmental sustainability in there and community input.
Definitely. Sustainable practices were encouraged, and crucially, affected communities had to be involved. Active participation was written right in.
So strong principles, but principles need enforcement, or maybe facilitation in this case. That brings us to the new institutions you mentioned. The commission and the tribunals.
Right. At the national level, you had the Development and Planning Commission. Its role was more advisory, advising the minister, checking if policies aligned with those general principles we just discussed.
Okay, so the commission is strategy and oversight.
Mm-hmm.
What about the provincial development tribunals? They sound like where the action happened.
They really were. Chapter 3 set them up specifically to make decisions and resolve conflicts for land development projects on the ground. They were the engine rooms, provincially based.
Resolve conflicts. Does that mean court battles or something else?
Something else, ideally. The act actually pushed them towards mediation first. Before a full hearing, tribunals were required to consider referring disputes to mediation, trying to find quicker, less adversarial solutions.
Makes sense if speed is the goal. And who sat on these tribunals? Just lawyers.
No, that was key. They were designed to be multidisciplinary. You'd have experts in planning, law, environment, engineering, agriculture, getting all the relevant knowledge in the room to make informed decisions.
Okay, so principles, new, faster institutions. What was the third piece? The new legal tool for tenure.
Ah, yes, initial ownership. This is probably one of the most innovative and maybe complex parts of the act found in Chapter 7.
Initial ownership. What exactly is that? It sounds like not quite full ownership.
That's basically it. It was a special intermediate form of title. You could register it in the deeds registry before all the usual, often lengthy, processes for full ownership were completed. It gave the holder the right to occupy and use the land, almost like an owner.
Okay, occupy and use.
Yeah.
But what's the real benefit? Why create this extra step?
Finance. Crucially, initial ownership could be mortgaged. You could use it as security. This unlocked access to subsidies and loans, what they called end user finance, much earlier in the process. People could get funds to build or improve their homes sooner.
Got it. So it's like a starter title that gives you immediate rights and, importantly, lets you access capital right away.
Exactly. It was a bridge, a way to provide security and enable investment quickly. And the act specified that this initial ownership would automatically convert to full standard ownership once all the usual requirements for registration were eventually met.
So putting it all together for you listening, this act tried to build a whole new system. It set demanding principles focused on integration and correcting history. It created specialized tribunals designed for speed and mediation, not just legal fights. And it introduced this unique initial ownership tool to get secure tenure and finance flowing fast, especially to communities left behind by apartheid.
Right. The whole thrust was about accelerating development, getting people onto land with secure rights quickly, sometimes bypassing the slower, more traditional bureaucratic steps, which leads to a critical thought to leave you with. When you prioritize rapid settlement and this kind of early stage ownership, what happens down the line? What are the potential long-term trade-offs when speed takes precedence over the slower, perhaps more thorough, traditional processes of planning and full title registration right from the start?